You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Saban Center for Middle East Policy here at the Brookings Institution. I am Kenneth Pollack. I am one of the senior fellows here at the Saban Center. In the last few weeks, Syria seems to have taken over the Middle Eastern stage, and certainly the Middle Eastern stage is seen from Washington. We're all very concerned about Syria for a whole variety of reasons. But when you think about America's interests in the region and in Syria, so much of it really is about Syria's neighbors. And I think that we sometimes lose sight of that fact, that Syria itself is a tragedy. And that in and of itself engages America's interests, America's interest in the region. But when we ask ourselves, what are our vital interests in the region, it is more about Syria's neighbors. It is about our NATO ally Turkey. It is about our close friend Israel and Jordan. And it is about our friend Iraq. Iraq, which we've tried very hard to forget. And I think unfortunately so. Because Iraq remains a critical player in the region and becoming ever more critical with each passing month. Iraq has become the second largest oil exporter in OPEC. Okay. And Iraq's oil production is expected to grow apace. And in fact, the most recent EIA estimate suggests that Iraqi oil production is likely to account, or increased Iraqi oil production is likely to account for 45% of the global growth in oil. That's going to be absolutely critical to overall global economic growth over the next 5 to 10 years. And so wither Iraq, very much wither the global economy. If the global economy is to continue to grow at the pace that has been set for it, Iraq's continued stability, its ability to continue to contribute to the global oil market is going to be absolutely critical. And for that reason, we're absolutely delighted to have with us today Iraq's new ambassador to the United States, His Excellency Luqman Faley. Excuse me. Luqman Faley is someone new to Washington, but I think well-known to a number of people here in our audience. I will start by saying that Ambassador Faley began his life with a very distinguished career in the private sector in the high-tech field. We need to be careful. He has both undergraduate and graduate degrees in mathematics and computer science. As someone with nothing but degrees in the social sciences, I get really nervous around people like that, people with real degrees, as we call them. After 20 years in the private sector, after the fall of Saddam Hussein, Ambassador Faley joined the Iraqi Foreign Ministry, where he served in Baghdad and then went on to have a very highly regarded tenure as Iraq's ambassador to Japan. And I will also say that when Iraq's prior ambassador to the United States, Samir Soumedi, you'll pardon me, I have a frog in my throat, stepped down as ambassador, there was a great deal of speculation. Nobody knew who was going to take his place. Samir had done very well in Washington. It had become very much a Washington fixture. And I think there was a lot of trepidation, both in Baghdad and here, about who was going to take his place. And I heard rumors, dozens of different names circulated, some very interesting, some who I was very concerned about what kind of a job they were going to do here. And then over the summer, I started getting emails from friends in Baghdad saying they picked Luqman Faley. You don't know him, but you're going to love him. He's one of the best. With that, Mr. Ambassador, the floor is yours.
I don't know where to start after such an introduction. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Ken, thank you very much for your introduction. I very much appreciate your introduction toward the importance of Iraq, more so toward the current situation of Iraq in relation to Syria and in relation to the regional situation. I very much appreciate that generous introduction, and also would like to thank Saban Center for hosting me. It's a great pleasure to speak at this prestigious event. It's a pleasure also for me to be here this afternoon and to make the case for why Iraq's renewed effort to establish a strategic partnership between Iraq and the United States are important more than ever before. Since the Tunisian uprising that sparked a wave of popular protest across the region back in December 2010, the Middle East has undergone and continues to undergo fundamental transformations that are shifting the socio-political dynamics in the region and beyond. The Arab Spring has yielded new opportunities for many of our Arab brothers and sisters to chart a course toward a new social contract in which prosperity and social justice are the core drivers for that movement. However, we have all seen the subsequent power vacuum have also made way for the resurgence of old threats, namely extremism, organizations such as Al-Qaeda, and sectarianism as core values or core drivers in the region politics. What started off as a pro-democratic protest is sadly sliding toward polarization of communities along sectarian and regional and religious lines. Needless to say, Iraq's own security has been adversely impacted by the region's instability and, in particular, by the situation in neighboring country Syria. In recent months, level of violence in Baghdad and elsewhere have spiked off, as Al-Qaeda and its affiliate trying to push Iraq towards civil war. Amid this background, Iraq seeks to strengthen its relationship with the United States in order to help stay on track toward establishing a strong, democratic, prosperous country that is a source of stability in the region. Bearing this in mind, I have been dispatched by my government with the primary mission of nurturing an enduring partnership with the United States. Our message to our American friends is simple, but it's urgent. In a region that is filled with so many uncertainties, Iraq can be trusted and it can be a reliable ally. There are no illusions here. We are under no illusions and neither should you. Much work needs to be done on both sides for this vision and a strong, enduring partnership to become a reality. But we do not need to start from scratch. Our two countries have endured much together over the past decade. Both of our great nations have made great sacrifices for the sake of establishing a free and democratic Iraq. On that note, I would like to extend my country's appreciation to all the American servicemen and women who served in Iraq, some of whom paid the ultimate price for the sake of free and democratic Iraq. I was honored that one of my first duties as the new Iraqi ambassador in Washington was to visit the Arlington Cemetery, or Arlington Memorial, to pay a tribute to our fallen, to your fallen sons and daughters. The nature of our bilateral relationships has been articulated through the Strategic Framework Agreement, which was designed by our two countries at the end of 2008. It outlines the basis for long-term friendships and cooperation, based on the principle of equality and sovereignty. It defines areas of cooperation across a whole host of political, economical, cultural, and security areas. Among its core principles, the agreement state, and I quote, "A strong Iraq capable of self-defense is essential for achieving stability in the region." Let me repeat it again. "A strong Iraq capable of self-defense is essential for achieving stability in the region." Much has been achieved. Iraq was the first country in the region to move from dictatorship to democracy. We have successfully held three free elections, national elections, and a number of provisional elections. One of these elections was held recently, despite our security challenges. Notwithstanding all our challenges, Iraq has managed to harness its oil wealth to rising level standards. We have reduced poverty and unemployment, and Iraq has asserted itself as a credible actor in the Middle East, culminating in its own removal from Chapter 7 of the UN Charter earlier this year. We have come a long way, but more hard work is needed to maintain our achievement in the face of a growing threat of terrorism and extremism and sectarianism. Since the collapse of Saddam regime back in 2003, Iraq has sought to adopt a foreign policy that no longer threatens international security and stability. While the new Iraq has tried to remain a neutral player, it has inevitably been drawn in the regional rivalries. By virtue of its geography and history, my country cannot realistically remain a passive observer in such a climate. But we have chosen to adopt an impartial stand in any conflict affecting our neighbors, and this is the same in our Syrian position. In other words, it is in Iraq's interest to play an active role in helping to resolve crises that may impact our national security. But we do not wish to take sides, and we firmly believe, as our Constitution has stipulated, in the principle of non-interference in our domestic in the domestic affair of our neighbors and others. This policy is demonstrated in our position on Syria. Since day one, we have said that there are no military solutions to resolve this conflict, and only a negotiated settlement between the warring parties can bring any hope of peace and justice to our Syrian brothers. Last week, our Prime Minister Maliki outlined a 9-point initiative that details how a potential ceasefire could be achieved. Iraq and the United States share the fundamental interest in ensuring that the flames of the Syrian civil war do not engulf the region. We also share a common enemy in Al-Qaeda that continues, along with other extremist elements, to try to undermine what we have built together in Iraq and to hijack the aspirations of the Syrian people. This is why it's crucial that we work closely to diminish the role of extremism in the region. Many have accused Iraq of facilitating Iranian military overflights bound for Damascus. I have been vocal in Washington in expressing my government's categorical rejection of military support for the Syrian regime. We have called on our American allies to support us in building an integrated air defense system that can prevent our airspace from being used to funnel armament to Syria. Just last month, my own minister, Minister Zibari, was here in Washington making the case for greater security cooperation and reaffirming our commitment to the Strategic Partnership Agreement with the United States. While security and defense cooperation is important, we believe that trade and commerce should be at the heart of any endeavor to foster deeper and long-lasting ties between our two countries. Iraq has the fastest-growing economy in the region, and it is expected to grow at a rate of 9.4 annually throughout to 2016. But this growth is mostly derived from our oil production, which has eclipsed Iran to become the second largest OPEC producer. Diversifying Iraq's economy and attracting investment capitals and foreign expertise are among our top priorities, more so for me here in the United States. Last month, I went to California to meet with the business leaders from among the Americans' most successful enterprises, and I was delighted to hear their enthusiasm for the Iraqi market. And in the meantime, Iraq is purchasing $10 billion worth of military equipment from the U.S. companies and firms. America's top energy companies are already working in Iraq. And our recent purchase of 30 Boeing planes for our Iraqi national carrier testifies to our potential as a market for U.S. goods and services. To summarize, amidst the turmoil and uncertainties in the Middle East, we are more determined than ever to build an enduring partnership with the United States. Much work needs to be done to strengthen our democracy, to counter the rising threat of terrorism, and to rebuild a strong and prosperous nation that can help alleviate some of the region's misfortunes. We see in the United States a fitting partner to help us realize our own full potential. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I think that's a great way to kick us off. You covered a lot of ground in those brief remarks, and I thought that I would start with the core of our relationship. You mentioned that Foreign Minister Zebari was here to
Yes.
reaffirm the commitment to the partnership between the two countries, and you also mentioned the Strategic Framework Agreement, which
Uh-huh.
was intended to be the blueprint for a comprehensive partnership between the two of us. I think it's safe to say, I don't know if you'd agree with me, I think you would, though, that both countries have really fallen down in turning that into something meaningful, into something that really could be a tangible partnership. And I'd love to ask you for your thoughts on what you'd like to see from the American side in terms of turning the Strategic Framework Agreement from something on paper into something in reality, and then also, obviously, what we should expect from Iraq on that same score.
Sure. Thank you very much for starting on such an important topic. The Strategic Framework Agreement was signed in 2008, just before President Obama came to power, with a view of ending the military presence of the United States and starting to work on a comprehensive relationship. The framework highlights areas of cooperation in security, in military cooperation, in commercial, in cultural, in medical care, and so on, in education, so on. So we can see that two countries both agreed to supplement and support each other in defining the areas of cooperation. With that in mind, you also have the realities of the U.S. troop withdrawal after 2011, which meant that the relationship has somewhat transformed from one of U.S. presence to one of sovereignty, and in which the relationship is one of partners. To us, that new definition has become transformational in our institutions. Likewise, I feel that in the United States, they are somewhat unfamiliar with such a new framework. Historically, U.S. forces usually used to maintain in the country before, and the relationship was one of bilateral based on specific sectors. Here we have a comprehensive relationship. I feel as though that both countries are on experimentary role here, and both countries are trying to identify areas of cooperation in which both feel it's urgent and both feel that they're capable of providing support to each other. With that in mind, I think we in Iraq need to relook at our strategic view of relationships. We as a country are new to having strategic relationship with any country. I was in Japan and I had that challenge all the time, in which we as a country have a mentality of one size fit all. Now we have a strategic relationship. To change that mentality, it means that we need to look at preferential relationship in areas such as energy or others. That's, to me, one of the homeworks I have to work on. From a United States perspective, I feel as though that is new to them as well. To get sight of Iraq and understand the potential of Iraq versus the legacy of Iraq in the U.S. discourse. I feel that currently Iraq has a negative connotation here in D.C. And to me, that's a strategic issue. And to me, that's an area in which I hope to change. More importantly, I think it's in the U.S. interest that the investment in Iraq is rewarded. People of Iraq want to embrace that relationship. I come in with the full support, not just of government, more so of the people. I'm not aware of any stakeholder in our own internal politics who would like to have but a strong relationship with the United States. We are choosing that relationship. There are no longer U.S. forces there. It's important that the U.S. audience understand that. We are choosing that relationship. However, we are choosing it on areas in which we need that type of support. We need that type of stability for our political, economical, and also we're talking about even the education, for example, of our students.
Mr. Minister, do you have any? Are there any particular areas where you think we should start? Because, as you point out, the Strategic Framework Agreement is all encompassing. It really does run the gamut. I think that is ultimately one of its strengths. But are there specific programs or specific areas where you think it might be good to start with, where you think there's potential or where Iraq has a particular need, and we could say, start with this? As you say, it's kind of experimental, and then we kind of get that going and see how it works.
It's true. However, you have to understand, Ken, that we have an urgency of needs. The framework we are embracing, as one of the key, if not only country at this moment we have that framework with, from Iraqi perspective. We have an urgency of a number of needs. The stability, the welfare of our people is of that need. National security interests of Iraqis, whether it's terrorism, whether it's areas of need in energy, whether it's services and others, this is where we're coming from. We have the funds, we need the technology, we need the know-how, we need the partnership. It's important that the relationship is looked at from one of partnership. Let me give you an example. While I was in Japan, the key relationship was one of started on trade. My job was to change it from one of what I might call from a business background, a client-supplier relationship to one of partnership. Partnership means you have to look at the interests of each other and not become the afterthought of events. The situation in Syria, we appreciate that. However, we are a stable, important country in the region, geopolitically as well as others. So it's important that the U.S. focus on us, should focus on fulfilling our needs, security cooperation, military cooperation. Yeah. These are immediate needs, in addition to the services which we talked about as well before. We have vast amount of requirements and needs across. We also have the funds. We have the vision for that. We're choosing the partner. Takes two to tango.
You mentioned the security needs, Mr. Ambassador, and I think everyone here is well aware of the kind of worrying increase in violent attacks in Iraq, in particular by al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Are there specific things that you would like to see the United States helping more with in terms of Iraq's security?
There are already discussions between the various committees, the various subcommittees within the various Iraqi apparatus institutions, security apparatus institutions, with the U.S., and we're already having that dialogue and discussion. However, what we feel, and I was in Iraq only 2 days ago, I came back 2 days ago, I had a lot of extensive meetings. What we feel is that urgency, sense of urgency, is not very much appreciated. In a sense that people come back to us and say, well, you have this life cycle of military hardware need to be sold and others. We appreciate that, and I'm not new to that area. Mm-hmm. However, I know that our own people's lives are endangered because of that. So if we're talking about partnership, let's talk about that on the tangible element, on the ground. What does partnership mean? It means look after each other's interests. We're here to do the fight in the region on behalf of everybody, when we talk about al-Qaeda. We suffered for the last 10 years. We were not the only victim of al-Qaeda. We know that. But we were the spearhead of the fight against al-Qaeda. To be the spearhead, that means you need to have the resources, the capabilities, and also the will of everybody to support you in that. And to us, this is an important issue. Our fight against al-Qaeda is not one of political discourse. It's one of survival and existence. So I think it's important people appreciate that as well.
On this same topic, or at least a related topic, I think that one of the concerns that many in the United States have is about some of the internal frictions that have arisen in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I think there are a lot of people who see the increase in al-Qaeda-inspired violence and enacted violence in Iraq as being a manifestation of the friction between the Sunni community and the central government. Can you give us a sense of where that's headed? I know that there have been a lot of negotiations going back and forth, but where does that stand right now, and what's your sense of how that might move forward?
We have never looked at the al-Qaeda as a sectarian element within the society. It's more of a political existence or rule of law. Let me give you some examples. The recent elections in Anambar, those who won in the elections were not of the extremist element. On the contrary, they were talking primarily about services. And they won the provisional elections based on services. If the current discourse in the U.S. that it's all about sectarianism and all about marginalization, then you would imagine that extremists will win in elections. They haven't. The Anbar's governor, four times he had assassination attempts based from people within his province. It wasn't Shia coming from south or anywhere else. So it wasn't that it was an inner fight, Sunni inner fight. No, it's an extremism versus those who believe in stated law and a democratic process of Iraq. We have elections. I think I am not aware of anybody even questioning in any minute level the fairness of the elections, the provisional elections or the government elections, which means that the will of the people are being respected. Those who do not want to adhere to the rule of law, unfortunately, have no space in our political daily situation, nor do they have a space in our community corporations and inner community work. To that effect, I think Al-Qaeda is a cancer element. And the affiliates, I'm not only blaming this on Al-Qaeda right. or tagging Al-Qaeda. I'm talking about those who are against the political new situation in Iraq or new discourse of Iraq. What we're working on with the government is trying to work closely with communities to go back to what we went through back in 2005 and 6 and 7 with Al-Sahwa and others. This is an area which we are re-looking at. We're also looking at some injustice where people were imprisoned without due consideration for rule of law, and we're going through that process. We are new to democracy. As a country, we are new to that. It's an old country. It's a situation between your body and your mind. If you have a two-second delay, you always have that problem between the body and the mind. Here, we have the same situation. You have a sharp body in which your political process have moved in within 10 years, what it takes 20, 30, 40 years for others to go through. However, your body, your institutions, still lagging to take you further away. And it's important that we embrace democracy as a practice across our political systems, not just in governance.
So I think a very hopeful message. I think one that every American hopes that Iraq is able to make continue down that path. There's obviously another source of internal friction, one that you're intimately acquainted with, mm-hmm. and that's the issues between the KRG, the Kurdish region,
yes.
and the central government. And I'd like to ask you the same thing there. Again, my sense is that there's been some important progress in recent months, some hopeful signs, but I'd like you to give us a sense of where things are headed between the central government and the KRG.
Okay. Before I answer that, I think it's important that for people to understand Iraq, there are certain attributes, certain elements they have to understand. One of the key questions we have in which inside Iraq ourselves, we are still struggling to get that right balance within a democratic framework, and that's the balance between justice and peace, between fairness and political stability. This is still ongoing, and this is to do with the remnants of having of the Ba'athist attack on us, and also of moving away from dictatorship and from central government. That's still question, still unanswered, and we're practicing with democracy as a method of us providing fairness to the people, providing some political ability or capability for the various provinces. So to that effect, we're still ongoing, still unclosed chapter, and still the story going on. In the same context, the element of federalism is still new to us.
The situation of KRG stated or was there before the 2003. So people have to understand that KRG as a political entity started in 91. So they already have that institutions in place. With the constitution in 2005, we verified that framework. However, people in Iraq may still look at the federalism as a political entity rather than as an administrative process, which means that we have to go through that educational process as well. In that, with bearing that in mind, what we have here in KRG versus Baghdad is the roles and responsibilities of the provinces versus central government. People come to us and say, why are you trying to consolidate power? We're going back with a clear statement that we have an issue of the maturity of the institutions of government, provinces and central. We also have the challenges of disbursements of budgets and so on. And we have challenges there because of the governance issue we talked about before. So it's within that context, there is still uncertainty between the roles and responsibilities of central government versus provinces, whether it's KRG, governor of Basra, or others. Governor of Basra, the previous governor, was calling for federalism, yet he was party, he was a senior member of the prime minister's own party. So the discourse is not one about marginalization, it's more about the understanding how federal system work together. And we're new. You guys are, have the experience. We haven't got that. So in that context, the relationship between Baghdad and KRG is one evolving. We try, the ice has been broken between them. Now there is a more melting of that ice. There is visits between the prime minister, a cabinet, our own cabinet formed, had a session in Erbil. The president of KRG, President Barzani, came to Baghdad. His prime minister came. So we're working closely to that. If you tell me, is that situation, is that chapter closed? I will say no. It's still evolving because we have a democratic process. And nobody wants to go to militia or force, but use parliamentary processes and discourse. So to our situation, the key question is people willing to talk to each other to the last, until the last moment? Yes, they are. Are they thinking about alternative solutions? No. Everybody is adhering to parliament. However, it may seem slow, however it may seem that it's sometime not working collaborative together, yes. But we are paying, we are willing to pay that cost for the sake of democracy.
Let's expand the conversation a little bit beyond what's going on inside Iraq. I'm very glad that you raised Syria. As you know, we're all infatuated with Syria for the moment. And I think you're aware that there's been a lot of consternation among Americans about exactly where Iraq stands. And I appreciated the clarity that you expressed in your statement. But I'd love to ask you to expand on that a little bit. You know, we get the fact that Iraq lives in a tough neighborhood. Caught between Syria on the one hand, Iran on the other. Iran is a big, powerful player in the region. I think we all understand that, but I think that many Americans are struggling to understand what a partnership could look like with Iraq on some of these regional issues, where we have one particular view and some of your other neighbors have a different view. So help us understand a little bit more of the thinking in Baghdad with relationship to the Syrian war.
Okay. To talk about that, first we need to understand the landscapes of Iraq. Iraq is the fourth line in the region from a sectarian situation. We're also a fourth line in relation to the oil field south versus north. Mm. Talk about the Sham area, the Syrian, Lebanon, others versus the Gulf state. Right. We are the only country with a neighborhood of Turkey and Iran who are not Arabs. Most of our Arab neighbors don't have that problem. So in a way, we are already in an area in which diversity of stakeholders and their background is one of. And you talked about the neighbors, and we have a proverb which people don't choose their neighbors. So we have to live with the realities of where we are with. So in that context, we have gone through an experience in which Syria is going through now, to a certain extent. We have learned the hard way about these lessons. We've learned that military solutions is not the way out. Suffering will not stop for the Syrian people if there is a military solution to it. Unfortunately, it will not. Unfortunately, Syria do not have the wealth of resources which we have in Iraq in order for us to resolve those situations. Syria haven't got the oil fields, nor have it got that geographical position which we have preferentially in relation to wealth and the Gulf and so on. So in a way, Syria starts with a disadvantage. We start with a good knowledge of that history, being the guy on the block. So we know the terrain. We know the stakeholders. We have clarity of how the Ba'athist system in Syria apparatus work, how the Mukhabarat and others work. We are not fond of that. We never had, we even went to the Security Council in 2009 complaining about Syria. And in my own ministry got blown up as part of that campaign. So we know that this is not where we're coming from as friends with Assad regime. However, we also know that the Syrian people should not continue to suffer. We know that military solution will not help. The war of attrition, which is taking place in Syria, with the three elements of resources, people, life, and time, both sides have it, which means that there will be a prolonged process. That prolonged process means more bloods for our Syrian brothers. It's unacceptable for us. We also have our own national interest to bear in mind with the situation of spillover. We currently have refugees, 210,000 coming to the Kurdish, 500 to 1,000 refugees every day come to Iraq. So we have a dilemma to deal with, you know, in the lives and welfare of our brothers in Syria. With all that in context, we cannot see a military solution as the easy way out, or a short-term, or even a long-term solution to it. And dialogue and Geneva too, or whatever platform is there, has to be the tool forward. We know this may not be popular in D.C., but it's important that people appreciate where we're coming from, and they have a better understanding of the terrain on the ground. The current discourse of trying to have a quick military operation will not work. What is the day-after scenario? That's the question I've been asking here. I haven't heard the right answer yet.
What do you think the right answer is? I'm dying to know.
We cannot see a situation in which the welfare of the various communities of Syria are not taken into consideration. Al-Qaeda does not allow others, physically, period. That's where you need to come from. The Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda elsewhere, extremism as a school of thought, cannot accommodate others. We're coming from that perspective. We know any solution with the dominance of Jabhat al-Nusra or Dawlat al-Sham and Iraq or whatever other names and tags they are using nowadays will not work without due consideration to the welfare of the minorities of Syria, whether they're Alawite, the Kurds, the Christian, whomever they are, even Sunnis who are against Al-Qaeda. You have to accommodate for them as well. So it's important that the other communities can see a day, as can see light at the end of the tunnel. Currently, they don't see it. Trying to take the Syrian regime out without providing an alternative political solution is one people cannot accommodate in Syria as well as in Iraq.
Let's shift south, if you don't mind.
Sure.
As you know well, not all of Iraq's neighbors to the south have been perhaps as forthcoming, I think, as either Iraqis or Americans would have liked them to have been. There's been variances. I don't want to group them all together. Yeah. I think that some have been much better than others. But I think part of this partnership should be the U.S. helping Iraq in areas where it needs help. How do you think that we together, Iraq and the United States, might better approach your neighbors to the south and bring them around in a way that we haven't been able to yet? Do you think that there's a way of doing that that we haven't tried?
I'm sure there are ways we haven't tried, and I'm sure there will be new ways, and I'm sure we have tried and failed, and I'm also sure we've tried on some of them and we have got good results.
Right.
Our relationship with most of our southern countries, in the Gulf primarily, is one of friendship. Our constitution has stipulated clearly not to get involved in the affairs of others. When the situation in Bahrain came up, we formally, political parties as well as the government, pushed toward a peaceful resolution and also toward not engulfing that situation in Bahrain, because we appreciate and we know that. Same in our neighbors as well. However, we talked about the partners of the United States. We know that the United States has strategic partnership with some of our neighbors. We are looking forward for the United States to support us, not in us having a preferential relationship, not in us in taking more than our share, no, but in us, in our existence, in acceptance of the political reality of Iraq. The post-2003 realities has to be understood on the ground. As they used to say, the genie is out. You cannot take it back to that. To us, it's important that people understand that political process is what we want, and the respect for our neighbors is what we want to adhere to. More importantly, the benefits, the commercials, as well as other type of relationship with our neighbors and investment and others, Iraq does provide that opportunity. So there is no benefit for the United States just to be idle in that effort. And they are not, to be fair to most of all my interaction with our colleagues in the State Department and others. They are trying to do their fair. Yes. However, are they doing enough from our side? No. Are they understanding the urgency of our needs to stabilize our countries? We somewhat sometimes question that. Yes. When elections comes in, we will have elections next year. It would be nice for our neighbors to leave us alone and try for us, for our own internal affair, to have that discourse and have that discussion, rather than to try to influence as who should be the next prime minister and others. I think the Iraqi domestic politics has told everybody, and Ken, I know you're an expert in that, that it's hard to predict. And therefore, it's important that you let it take its own course.
Thank you. I want to turn over to the audience in just a moment, but I want to ask you one more question, Mr.
Sure.
Ambassador. I just can't resist. You know, next week we're going to have President Rouhani coming to New York,
mm-hmm.
And he is going to make his, you know, debut on the world stage. And obviously, I think Americans have very high hopes for Mr. Rouhani. You know, as an Iraqi, you can't help but not pay attention to what goes on in Iran. And I'd love to just get your thoughts on what you think of what's going on in Iran. And should we, is Mr. Rouhani the real deal? Should we take this seriously? What are your thoughts on what's happening there?
Obviously, as an Iraqi, I have a selfless interest in the relationship between United States and Iran becoming more normalized and more predictable and on a healthy ground. We sometimes feel, actually, let me rephrase that. We know that Iraq is sometimes looked at from the prism of Iran. And to us, this is not a healthy relationship. Not just from the United States, but from other countries as well. In their adversarial relationship with Iran. In their view of Iran post the nuclear situation, the militarization of nuclear usage from Iran. So to us, it's important that Iraq is looked at from Iraqi perspective. And we see the President Rouhani coming to power as a statement by the Iranian establishment and the Iranian people that they are looking for a mutual, beneficial, positive relationship with the United States and with other countries. Rouhani didn't come in just by the chance. It was a natural manifestation of the discourse within Iran for their position following the two terms of Ahmadinejad. From that perspective, I think it's a positive element. Whether the pace of change or perception of pace of change is to the same level which the United States is expecting, I somewhat doubt. Mm. The Iranians usually have a long view of things, and I would suspect that long view will not be unique and will not be switched off during the upcoming United Nations General Assembly.
And neither will the centrifuges, I assume.
I don't know about that. But what I'm saying is that their long view of things is one which I feel that sometimes is not looked at or perceived from the United States. And vice versa as well. The national interest of the United States sometimes is not perceived in Iran. To us, it's a tragedy that two countries who have strong history together, whom people admire each other, that's very important. I've been to Iran a number of times. I've never heard people's negatively talking about the United States as a people and so on. So to me, it's important that that's taken advantage of. And more importantly, that Iran should not be looked at as one incident and then we switch off. It has to be an ongoing endeavor by United States, by Iran, toward a political resolution. The area, the region, the world cannot afford a military solution to the situation. The region cannot afford a continuous tension. I think United States have tried looking east. Now they found that, as you said in your op-ed, now they found that the Middle East is important and will remain to be important.
Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Okay, I'd like to open it up to questions for the audience. I'm going to ask two things, please. Actually, I guess I'm going to ask for three things. Please wait for the microphone. We've got microphones coming down. Second, please identify yourself, name, affiliation, and please ask a question. You know, not just making a statement and then saying, what do you think of what I said? We'll start with David over here.
David Mack from the Middle East Institute. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for taking this very important assignment for Iraq. When Foreign Minister Zebari was here a few weeks ago, he indicated he would be going to Ankara, expressed some optimism for the evolution of Turkish-Iraqi relations, which have been troubled. Could you update us on that?
Yes, of course. I think that I was with the minister, and there were two options, either for him to go to Ankara or to meet with the Turkish foreign minister in Geneva. And they did meet in Geneva, and senior officials from Turkey have come to Iraq, and they will come more. And also a visit by the foreign minister to Ankara is on its way. We know Turkey is an important country, but we also know that the respect for our own decisions regarding our own energy policy, our own Kurdish situation and others have to be respected. And we appreciate that there's certain issues in Turkey in dealing with its own Kurdish element and so on. With that in mind, I think it's important, as we have the discussion with our southern countries, that our northern country as well, Turkey, respect the new Iraq and respect the interest of both countries. There are a lot of areas of cooperation for us to explore. We did it before. We can do it again.
Lady right down here.
This is Ragad Al-Sadi, and I am a congressional fellow with Congressman Jim McDermott, and I am originally from Iraq. My question to the ambassador is on the legislative branch in Iraq, how much of a progress that the Iraqi MPs have made to establish a good democratic system within the legislative system? How much of checks and balances inside the government of Iraq? And that definitely would impact the relationship of the partnership between the Iraq and the U.S. to have equal balance between the two countries. Thank you.
We have a vast amount of legislations awaiting approval and ratification and other levels within Parliament. For our democracy to cement and to flourish, we need a few legislations which are in place, in pipeline, and that's to do with party law and election law. Those two are awaiting. There's a strong discussion in Iraq now as to these has to be ratified prior to our next election. It's important that that discourse as to the provinces, as to the scope of parliamentaries, the roles of parties, the funding for parties and so on need to be cleared up. This issue we talked about before with Ken regarding our neighbors' influence, that's one of the elements. At this moment, we have no legislation in place, which is signed off. So we have a pipeline in the pipeline of Parliament, a couple of key legislations which we are working on. As to the relationship with the United States, I think it's clear here that I've never heard anybody in the United States tell me that Iraq is not democratic. They talk about the strength or the role of center government versus federalism, but that's an ongoing story. It's nothing to do with democracy. It's to do with what's practical and what's effective. And to us, the pace of change is tremendous, and the aspiration is tremendous. How can we match that with the right strategies and the right legislative framework in mind is where the key questions are.
Okay. Gary?
Mr. Ambassador, I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to add my thanks to you, along with David Mack, for some very thoughtful comments today.
My pleasure. What I'd like to
get a sense of from you is, when we talk in Washington, and particularly in places like Brookings, about creating partnerships and forging strategic partnerships, we tend to think about a very circumscribed amount of territory and a small number of people relatively, which is to say the administration and the Congress. It seems to me that the lesson Ken Pollack mentioned at the outset, that we're all infatuated, if that's the right word, with Syria at the moment. And I think it's fair to say that that one of the stark lessons of our experience with Syria, the current situation in Syria, is that the American people sent a message, which is, been there, done that, not going to do it again. And it's a broad brush, which unfortunately includes everything from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, it's a very anti-intellectual but gut-level kind of reaction. Therefore, if that's correct, I wonder to what extent you have given thought to building this partnership in a bottom-up instead of a top-down approach, in a more people-to-people kind of strategy, where more of us are coming to see Iraq and more Iraqis are coming here, though it will take more time and it will be less dramatic, it might over the long haul be the strongest. And I'd just be curious your thinking about that.
Sure. When I became an ambassador, I as a mathematician, as Ken talked about, I analyzed that relationship to the nth degree. And it was clear to me that there are key areas I need to work hard in breaking the ice. One is one of saying thank you for the United States, clearly making that statement that we appreciate what the United States did in the removal of Saddam, in the foundation and cementing of democracy, and in helping us in progressing on that political track. So that thank you is one of the key messages I will convey elsewhere. Same-wise, on the same level, appreciation of Iraq to have a strong relationship. From the Iraqi people, I'm not talking about the political class in Iraq. You may have some discourse or inner fighting in Iraqi politics as to the extent of the relationship with the United States. But the core of the people, the average Iraqis across all Iraq, whether it's from Basra to the Kurdish region, they all want to have that strategic relationship. And strategic doesn't mean military here. I'm talking about their sons to be sent to be educated at U.S. universities. I'm talking about for the healthcare, for the machinery to come from U.S. manufacturers. I'm also talking about fertilizers for their agriculture. So I'm talking about this is people-to-people needs rather than just the military or security cooperation, which government-to-government need to also to work on. So on that front, I've been going on the road campaigns. I went to California and others. Next week, I'm going to Houston, going to New York in early October to talk about that with the business-to-business, people-to-people, and also to get a role for our Iraqi community, diaspora here, to play that bridging role. It's important that Americans appreciate that we would like to have that relationship. We're choosing that relationship to break that ice, as talked about. In addition to that, the Eurasia view of U.S., looking at the Eurasia as one brush, which I sometimes dispute, there is one view of that Eurasia. However, even if there is that Eurasia view, it's an area in which historically, geopolitically, it has mattered. If you would like to keep your seats at the United Nations Security Council, you need to have a global perspective of things. Global perspective means that you carry on being the positive player on the ground, try to find solutions to the global issues, whether it's environmental or security or migration of people or refugees or whatever. It's important that you have that role. You want to play that role, there's a cost associated with it. I think it's important that that perspective is also looked at. From our situation, we would like to the United States to have that positive role in our internal politics, as well as support us with good governance, technology transfer, as well as our own security, which we talked about before. So it's important that people don't forget this global perspective of things, rather than look at Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan from one decade view. Nations' relationship should go beyond decades, beyond one decade, to go into the centuries.
Good. There's a hand in the back.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for the insightful remarks. My name is Omar Nadawi. I'm an Iraq analyst at Griffin Partners, a strategic advisory company. If I may ask two quick questions. First, as you mentioned, the urgency of Iraq's security needs and the volatility of the Iraq-Syria border. And I was wondering if you could tell us whether the Iraqi-U.S. Discussions have involved the possibility of utilizing American intelligence or counterterrorism assets to track or intercept al-Qaeda movements in Anbar province and across the border. Second question, following a meeting between Prime Minister Maliki and Speaker of Parliament Najafi, the Speaker, along with a delegation of parliamentarians, went to Ankara and afterwards to Iran to promote an Iraq initiative for peace in Syria. I wonder if you could update us on that and what you think is the next step in that direction.
Sure.
Thank you.
In answer to the second question, the initiative wasn't just on Syria, but to convey a message that the Iraqi political blocs, whether it's Najafi, whom people tag as the Sunni, or his colleagues who are Shia or Kurds and others, want to normalize relationship with Turkey and Iran. And the normalization of relationship means that they should respect our uniqueness and for us to have that positive relationship with them in trade and political cooperation and other, and security of the borders and so on. So this was the key message. And Syria was at the core of that visit, just to give them our perspective on things. Syria, and we know that Turkey and Iran have different drivers to that view of Syria. So we were there to give them the Iraqi perspective on it. In addition to as to the first question, the area of cooperation should be wide, and partners always need each other. So with that in view, we are more than happy, and we are in discussion with our American, in discussion on wide range of areas of cooperation. As you may appreciate, I cannot divulge more, but I know that a lot of cooperation taking place, more to maybe need to be, as what the situation on the ground entails. This is where we're coming from, and that's where we have positive message from our American friends.
How about the further back? There was a hand back in there. There it is.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Ambassador. I'm Eric Gustafson, the director of the Education for Peace in Iraq Center. I want to seize on something that you said earlier, and it also connects to this idea of improving people-to-people relations. But the idea that, you know, democracy is still new in Iraq, the institutions are still in formation. Do you see a future role for agencies like USAID beyond 2015 in providing technical assistance and working with institutions, education, other institutions, and strengthening those going forward? Thank you.
Sure. I have had discussions with a large number of organizations who have been involved in Iraq looking forward as to their future operations and future projects. To me, the key area, the key shift has been one of need from aid to one of support and partnership in knowledge transfer and in helping us with good governance. To me, governance is the key issue. We, as Iraqi institutions, need that support in helping us update our legislations, updating our processes, bringing new technology, bringing new management methodology into on the ground. And from that perspective, I cannot see any reason why the USAIDs and others and other institutions should not have a strong role in Iraq. To transform that relationship from one of physical needs to one of partnership, helping us in knowledge transfer. We need that. I used to do it in Japan. I'm here to embrace that more. It's important, however, that that vehicle is also highlighted as a branch or as an olive branch or as a sign from the United States to Iraq as a people, that this institution was modernized by a U.S. institution. In Iraq, the name JICA was, which is the main Japanese overseas development company organization, was highly regarded of by all the people because they could see a hospital assigned to that, or a water treatment, or a water sanitation, or a refinery has been developed by Japanese. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was significant as a sign of people standing by people, because we know this is taxpayers' money.
We've got one all the way in the back. Let's go up there.
Hi there, thank you, and apologies if this has been asked already. I was late, my train
Can you hold the microphone
late.
Up? It's a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Question actually for both of you. What's your take on the potential of Prime Minister Maliki seeking a third term? That law was just recently done away with that would prevent him from doing so. I'd be interested in both of your perspectives on that. Thank you.
I mean, I will say that I will leave that question to Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I thought I was just a moderator.
I have that privilege at least once, so let me do it.
I'll put it this way. If you've got a whole lot of money, I wouldn't bet that he isn't going to run. We take a question up here. We had a couple down here. That's great.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Karwan Zabari. I'm with the Kurdistan Regional Government's Representation Office here in Washington, D.C. It's good to see you again. Likewise, Ken. You briefly touched on the Syrian refugees headed to the Iraq border with the influx of heading to the KRG administered areas, totaling well over 200,000. The KRG leadership has asked the international community to come in and assist these refugees. What steps is the federal government in Iraq taking to help these refugees, considering winter is only a few weeks away? Thank you.
This winter is coming.
Yes. And unfortunately, the tragedy of the refugees is not becoming the paramount issue in the political discourse here in D.C. and elsewhere. And to us, that's a tragedy. The Kurdish people have already been through that. Our Iraqi Kurdish people went through it back in 1990, and we know that what it takes. And we also know that our drive and stamina should not be the only weapons we have in our army. We need that support from the nations. As a government, we have tried and we are working to try to understand exactly the type of support we need, whether it's financially or logistically. It's challenging when you have a 500 to 1,000 every day coming in. And it's also challenging when you have your own security interest to bear in mind. We had the challenge with the Syrian, and we unfortunately had to deal with the refugees slightly differently in trying to contain them and not open up, but provide school and healthcare and so on to them and try to keep them in the camps. Unfortunately, because of our own security, that meant that that situation did not have the aspiration of our government, sorry, the wish of our government to the level of support we were able to do. So I don't have the exact information at this moment as to what are the latest actions we're taking. I know that the government have dispatched people from south to try to get understanding. We're working with the Kurdish government, the local government, to ascertain as to the scale, the type of support. Is it financially, which I don't think that's an issue for us. It's not an issue of us putting some money. It's more on the logistics issue, providing the right tents, getting an understanding, dealing with the illness, talking about the winter issue. We have to bear in mind that the Syrian situation will not be resolved quickly. So we bear that in mind. We also know that the influx of refugees, as fear because of the chemical attacks and others, has increased significantly. And it's important that we have the right tools on the ground. We're working with the Kurdish government and trying to get an assessment. I personally don't have the latest information on that, but I know that fund is not the issue. It's more logistics of providing the tents and the food and the medical care and the education and so on, which is a tragedy for us.
There was a hand. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Dakhil Shama from Voice of America, the Kurdish Service. I know you touched the issue of the security and violence, but I just want to ask a question about the reasons. You know, the figures from UNAMI shows that the level of the civilian, Iraq civilian casualties is doubled from 2012 to 2013. So what has led to this increase of the violence and casualties?
What caused the increase of violence?
Yes, that caused the reasons.
It's taking advantage of the Syrian turmoil from the Qaeda point of view, smuggling more weapons, more sophisticated weapons, have more control of the desert in which they can mount and plan operations. Unfortunately, they have been, because we don't have air supremacy or we don't have the right armament, I'm talking about armored helicopters and so on, we have not been able to dominate the space, the air. And as a result, Al-Qaeda have utilized all their resources. What they have been doing is on and off between Iraq and Syria. Whenever there's an attack, they will go to Syria, get involved, and whenever there's a drawback, they come into Iraq and continue that operation. They are not short of aspiration to destruction. And to us, we've been suffering from that aspiration. We've been suffering from our hospitals being exploded. Funeral service, you know, when there's a funeral, people go in and blow themselves up. So unfortunately, it's become more indiscriminate and also become more wide because of the network they've been able to establish because of the Syria and because of our lack of focus. We lost focus as security apparatus. We lost focus, and Al-Qaeda took advantage of that. Now we're talking back with our partners to provide the right tools, the capabilities, and more importantly for us to learn, to understand the lessons learned from the prison break in Abu Ghraib and others.
Okay. Great, that gives me the... Oh, there is one more question back there.
Hi, I'm Chris Ayers. I'm a student at American University. And my question was, you mentioned earlier in your remarks that you wish for a political solution to Syria. But what possibilities do you see for a peaceful outcome? We've seen multiple attempts at ceasefires and only to end in failure. And with the rebels being so disorganized, what success do you see from efforts to broker peace? Thank you.
What success was, sorry?
How can we broker peace in okay. Syria?
The key question here is, okay, if you say that politics is not the resolution to it, what is? Military? I've talked about before the day after scenario. Would a military operation resolve it? Will another Desert Fox, as it took place in the 1990s against Iraq and others, resolve it? We doubt that. The Syrian regime have, as I said before, they are not an oil-producing country, which means that they have to govern by various methods and not just bribe people off or buy people's services off. To us, the Syrian regime is one of a complicated intelligence apparatus institutions, which means that looking for a military solution will not work. Also know that a military solution means more suffering for the people. The weapons coming to the government of Syria has been coming from various directions in various countries. There is no reason for that to stop soon, which means that the war of attrition, which I talked about before, will continue with the suffering of our people. The political resolution is when everybody knows that they can come to the table with a clarity that they can get something out. If you come to any party and say your existence will not be considered, why would they come to the table? So it's important that people look at it that way. You have to entice the players, whether it's Assad regime or others, to come to the table with an understanding that they can salvage something. As is now the current discourse, that's not the case. The alternative, as I talked about, the day after scenario, is also not available or not clear. I'm not aware of two stakeholders, however they are, whether it's American and any other partners, whether it's European and others, who have clarity as to the day after scenario. Or at least made it clear to the stakeholders, made it clear to the parties, or us, Iraq, as a neighbor, as to the day after scenario. To us, without that, we cannot find a solution but a military, but a political solution. Because, again, the Syrian regime have proven again and again that they are willing to stay in power whatever it takes. We have been saying that. My prime minister came here in D.C. in December 2011, and he made that clear statement. Actually, 2011, was it? He made that clear that I give you, they were saying about 2 months. He said, I'll give you 2 years and it won't resolve. Because we know Syria well.
Mr. Ambassador, I know that you were sent here by the Prime Minister of Iraq, by the Iraqi government, to rebuild the relationship, to forge that partnership that we've both been looking for between our two countries. And I just want to say thank you for choosing Brookings as the place to launch this new initiative. I, for one, wish you all the luck in the world. I think our two countries will be much the better off for it if you are successful. And I can only hope that you are, and I'm deeply grateful to you for launching this new initiative here at Brookings. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ken, for being here. Thank you, Ken, for being here.